it does not make sense for us as a society to be putting terrorist people convicted of terrorist offences, of serious violent offences, out on early release.
That's the UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson. After we found out that the man who was the stabber in the London Bridge incident on Friday had been let out of prison early after being convicted on terrorism charges. There were reports in British media that he had been wearing an ankle bracelet allowing police to track his movement at the time of the attack. And the obvious question becomes, how does this happen? How is someone allowed to be let out early and then go on to do something like this? Phil Gursky is the president and CEO of Borealis Threat and Risk Consulting. He's been on the show before on a lot of terrorism-related issues. He joins us on the line this morning. Phil, I mean, that's the big question, right? How does this happen?
No, you're absolutely right, Matt. But before we get to that, last time you and I talked, my friend, you said you'd bring me back on to talk about something positive.
That is true, I did.
This is not positive, my friend. No, there's a lot of very embarrassing questions and finger-pointing going on right now. And I think to complicate matters, they're in the midst of an election, which could or could not return Boris Johnson. The polls are showing he will return as prime minister. But this is the absolute worst thing in one way you want to have happen during an election campaign, a successful terrorist attack. And as you said, not just any terrorist attack, but one carried out by somebody who'd been convicted on terrorism and then released. So there are lots of people wondering, asking the same question you did, how the hell does this happen in 2019 in the UK?
What would be the first thing investigators would try to do in this? I guess it wouldn't be the frontline investigators. It would more be a review of the system to figure out how this happened. Would it be going back and seeing why he was released early? Is that the obvious first step there?
I would think so, but I would also submit that, so MI5, which is, the UK equivalent of CSIS, where I used to work, I'd be very surprised, Matt, if they weren't already following him again once he was released, because they wouldn't have any guarantees. He wouldn't have reoffended. So I'd be curious what MI5 knew about him. Did they have a warrant to intercept his communications? Did they have surveillance on him? Were they recruiting human sources against him? So I think there's a lot of people that will be asking questions about the early release, the decision why that was made. So my understanding is that there's some kind of risk assessment tool that prisons authorities would have used to determine that he was okay to let out early. Is that the right tool? Did somebody miss something? So there'll be a lot of people, I think, checking their files and saying, what did we know? When did we know it? And as you said, what went into the decision that this man was okay to release, even with an ankle bracelet? And there's some really disturbing parallels here in Canada, Matt, we should talk about with Aaron Driver. But, these are really tough questions.
Well, when someone's out on release from these types of charges, let's start with just a terrorism-related offense, and they're wearing an ankle bracelet, would there be somebody, like I think of a movie, right, where you got someone in a van outside the house watching this person all the time. It probably isn't like that just for budget reasons. What would be a realistic expectation of the monitoring that was done on this person? Obviously, somewhere along the way, something went wrong, but what would be a realistic expectation of the review this guy would be under?
Yeah, I hate to tell you this, Matt, but Nick Nolte and Eddie Murphy in a car doing surveillance is not the norm.
No, I would think it probably isn't, yeah.
It's resource intensive. And, I think the other thing that has to be borne in mind here is that, the UK, MI5, has identified publicly 23,000 people that they're worried about who adhere to some kind of terrorist ideology. Nobody has the resources to look at 23,000 people. And on the other hand, you prioritize. And I've seen the prioritization schedule that MI5 uses, and it's a tough call. You've got all these people and you rank them. Who's most likely to go and commit an act tomorrow or a week from now or a month from now? This is really, really time-consuming. It's resource-consuming. So even with an ankle bracelet, we had a case here, again, Aaron Driver, but also Martin Coutu-Hulot in Quebec City 2 days before the Happy Bow attacked here in Ottawa. He was on a peace bond. He was being monitored supposedly by the RCMP or local police, and he was able to get in a car and kill Warrant Officer Patrice Vincent before he was killed by police. So the bottom line, Matt, is that there are no guarantees. And so if there are no guarantees, what should we do about that? That's the tougher question as far as I'm concerned.
Would agencies right across the world be looking at something like this and going, okay, we need to double down and check the people that we're watching? Does that have repercussions internationally?
I think it does. I think it does here in Canada. And if I can go one step further, you and I have talked about the big debate about returning foreign fighters, Canadians who join ISIS and other groups coming back. That's resource intensive as well. So that might weigh into, should we in fact bring them back? The government's been quite quite adamant so far that we will not bring these people back to Canada because there's no legal obligation to do so. The UK is already reviewing all its cases. I just read that in the UK media this morning when I got up at Old Dark Hunter because I was in Finland last week. And they're going to be looking at all the files they have and double-checking and triple-checking and quadruple-checking. Is this guy okay to let out? And, of course, the knee-jerk reaction, Matt, from British citizens is lock them up, throw away the key, never let them out. Now, that's got pluses and minuses.
Yeah, but how realistic is that as a suggestion?
Well, it's not, right? I mean, we have a system in the Western world, generally speaking, in our penal systems, whereby we don't lock up people forever unless they're the worst, the worst, the worst. We try to rehabilitate, we try to reintegrate, and I personally think that's the right approach. That's just my personal opinion. So we're not going to go back to the days of, you know, hanging a guy at the dawn, but I think there are going to be some very serious questions. Again, you know, what tools do you have to assess threat, and how reliable are they? Have they been measured in terms of effectiveness? There's lots of tools out there, Matt, lots of risk assessment tools. And yeah, they're great, but none of them are perfect. And the problem in this kind of thing is that, you know, and I've said this to you before, I think, we're only as good as our last failure. This is clearly a failure somewhere along the line in the UK. And the people are going to start asking, well, why did you fail when you didn't have to?
Well, nobody's going to pay attention to any kind of intelligence service when they succeed, right? No, that doesn't get a ton of headlines. It might get a couple, but it's the failures that grab the most headlines for these types of incidents.
No, you're right. And, you know, in my time at CSIS, we foiled some incredibly complex plots, and people forget about them or dismiss them in some cases. It's funny, if I may, Matt, I'm actually giving a talk tomorrow at Ottawa U at 11:30 on the very topic of, you know, how big is a terrorist threat to Canada? And, you know, it's there because I worked cases and we were successfully preventing people from dying, which is great. But, you know, if it bleeds, it leads, right? This is your business. And unfortunately, people don't pay attention to the ones where no one bleeds. So, yeah, you know, these are all great questions, Matt. And unfortunately, none of them have really the answers.
So when something like this happens, how long would it take for checks and balances to be put in place so that it doesn't happen again? Would that have started right yesterday, or is there a long, tedious review process that goes on?
I'm not really sure about that, but I would be very surprised if they didn't suspend all pending releases until such time as they feel better about this. But, you know, that's only a matter of time, right? You and I both know that, you know, as time goes on, people forget, and it's not nearly as urgent because nothing's happened. So, well, maybe this guy's okay after all. Maybe he's really been de-radicalized, whatever the hell that's supposed to mean. I don't believe in the term. Maybe he's okay to release into society on conditions, ankle bracelets, reporting, whatever kind of thing. So I think that, you know, I mean, time heals all wounds. I'm not using that facetiously in this case, but people's memories are shallow and they're very short. And I think we'll be asking ourselves the same question 5 years when you call me again, Matt, to talk about something like this, and because something else has happened. So, but I would be very surprised if anyone gets anywhere near being released anytime soon in the UK.
Phil Gursky is here. He's the president and CEO of Borealis Threat and Risk Consulting. You heard him mention he's been, he had worked at CSIS in the past. And you mentioned the Aaron Driver case earlier. What kind of lessons did the Canadian system learn from that case?
Well, they certainly learned that peace bonds aren't perfect. So the peace bond is kind of the UK calls them control orders. Excuse me, we call them peace bonds. There were conditions on Aaron Driver. You know, he had to live with his sister. He couldn't do certain things. And yet he built a bomb and got into the back of a cab in Strathroy, Ontario in August of 2016. And luckily it was a lousy bomb and only he got hurt. But I don't know what, I mean, peace bonds are there for a reason. As I said earlier, we can't, you know, lock them up forever. That's not our system. But when you've only got so many resources in place and you know, again, surveillance is not like Nick Nolte and Eddie Murphy in a car in Hollywood. It takes resources and then you have to prioritize which ones you're looking at. So I don't think we're going to get rid of peace bonds anytime soon, and I don't think we should, but you got to ask yourself the question, maybe peace bonds aren't the best tool for convicted terrorists or alleged terrorists. Then you get, it's a whole civil liberties issue, right? You haven't convicted me of terrorism. I'm an alleged terrorist. Why can't I get the same privileges as a guy that, you know, steals from a local Max Milk? If we even have Max Milk anymore, I have no idea.
Right.
Or Shoppers Drug Mart.
But, and you also just can't lock someone up, which is what a lot of people would be calling for after seeing this, right? Why isn't he still in jail? This case in London would be a little bit different because at least the guy was convicted of something, but you can't just go round up people that you suspect may be up to something.
No, you're right. I think you hit a really good point, Matt, and that is this guy was a convicted terrorist. I don't recall offhand, because I'm dealing with jet lag right now, what he was convicted of. I think it was a plot in the UK, or maybe it was a plot to an ISIS, I don't remember. But you're right, he's different. He was convicted in a court of law. He had his chance to defend himself. He was found guilty and given a rather light sentence and then released, you know, under the system. That's different than Aaron Driver. You can't.
Yeah, it was an Al-Qaeda-linked group that he was accused of plotting major attacks with, including Parliament, the U.S. Embassy, and had listed some individuals like the prime minister and the mayor.
Oh, okay. Well, thanks. Yeah. But, you know, like I say, Aaron Driver was not convicted. He was alleged to have been a terrorist. In the end, he turned out to be a terrorist. But, you know, you can't throw someone in the clink for allegedly being a criminal, right? They have to have their day in court, and that's the way it should be. So I think there's a variety of different approaches we have to adopt here. But certainly the question on everyone's mind today, Matt, is does a convicted terrorist deserve to go free anytime soon? And in the wake of what happened a few days ago, the answer that most people will say is no.
Are there a number of convicted terrorists out in Canada right now?
Absolutely. In fact, to the best of my knowledge, the Toronto 18, if you remember those guys
right.
from 13 years ago, that was a case I worked on quite closely. It was the biggest terrorism investigation we ever had at CSIS. Best of my knowledge, only two of the Toronto 18 are still in jail. So 11 were convicted, 7 were acquitted, and of the 11 convicted, I'd be 4 or 5 got released immediately with time served. And the ringleader, to the best of my knowledge, is free. So what does that tell you?
Well, there we go.
Again, you know, nothing happened, right? No one died. No one was injured. There was no destruction. So was it really a serious plot? There are people in this country, Matt, who think that CSIS and RSMP make stuff up. That, you know, we pretend it's terrorists or that we're egging them on or, you know, engaging in sting operations or whatever. So the bottom line is, unfortunately, if nothing happens, people are less willing to consider it as very serious. And as a result, when these releases happen, no one really seems to shrug. Okay, one more prisoner released. Oh, well, I guess it's normal. I hate to say that, but that's the way it is.
Just before we let you go, you mentioned right off the top, and we played the clip of the British Prime Minister. It's an election happening right now in Britain. Does that put a lot more pressure on the organizations like MI5 to act in an election campaign, or is it just going to ramp up the rhetoric with the different candidates bringing this up to the forefront on the campaign?
Let me give you a real quick example to show what happened. So if you go back to 2004, remember the Madrid attack, the Madrid Metro?
Right.
200 people died, over like 1,600 wounded. That happened 3 days before a Spanish election. The Spanish government tried to blame the Basque separatists. We all know that was crap. Basques don't do that. That government lost the election because they were perceived by Spaniards as being unable to protect its citizens. So, you know, if something else happens between now and the election, it would look bad on Boris Johnson. Would it go to the point where he'd lose the election? Luckily, he's going against Jeremy Corbyn. From what I understand, he's not exactly the sharpest pencil in the box either. So hard to say, but yeah, there'd be a lot of pressure on MI5, on the Metropolitan Police, to make sure there's no repeat between now and when the British citizens go to the polls.
Thanks, Phil. We appreciate the insight as always.
My pleasure, Matt. Have a good one.